from deep inside your audio device of choice.
I hope you've chosen a good one, by the way. Those audio devices can make all the difference. Ladies and gentlemen, my job during the next 59 minutes is to turn a migraine into a your-grain. You're welcome. I'm in London, England, from a beautiful Leicester Square, all dolled up for the nothing that is mid-January in London. But I came over here because it's become apparent now, I think, to all that there are some of us in show business who like to dabble from time to time in journalism. And I guess you could say that I'm one of them. And some sources I had over here, I've been coming here from time to time over the last few years and developed some sources who put me in touch with a gentleman who is, I think, best known around the world as the world's poorest drug lord. His friends know him by the nickname El Cheapo. And we were supposed to have had an interview here today, but he decided to stay home and watch the rugby on telly instead. So we'll get on with the rest of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, the methane leak in Southern California in the San Fernando Valley, as if the valley wasn't, splendid enough, now it's got this leak, and it's getting worse. Independent researchers have reported detecting elevated methane levels as far as 8 miles from the Porter Ranch, which is where the massive ongoing leak of natural gas is occurring. It's a ruptured well. Ouch. Those don't heal. At an underground storage facility, it's spewed so far more than 80,000 metric tons of methane into the atmosphere. Just so you know, just so in case you're counting, this is a powerful greenhouse gas. It's the equivalent of like a million cars. But the scientists have now found elevated methane levels well beyond that area, the Porter Ranch area, raising health concerns for people living outside the vicinity of the leak. Inhaling low concentrations of methane, which is the primary component of natural gas, is okay. It's all right. Don't go putting your head in the oven just because I said that. Because natural gas often contains trace elements of other more harmful gases, benzene, toluene, xylene, all urines. This is what people may be breathing, said an earth and environment professor at Boston University. They're not measuring things other than methane, but there's a legitimate concern. He says that there's that other nasty stuff in there. That's a scientist talking. These challenge assurances, these findings from the Air Quality Management District in L.A., and the state's Office of Environmental Health, that the leak hasn't increased residents' exposure to toxic gases. So you don't pay your money and you take your choices. The cumulative methane emissions from the leak so far have the equivalent of burning nearly 800 million gallons of gasoline, according to the Environmental Defense Fund. SoCal Gas is still trying to do something to stop the leak. That's very much doing a really... And, corporations really don't have great gift for mimicry, but Southern California Gas is doing a really good impression of BP 6 years ago. And so, just among the reasons to stay out of the San Fernando Valley, add this one. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you hear all the time, not just in the Republican presidential debates, that we don't make anything in the United States anymore, especially anything that lasts. Everything's so mercurial and ephemeral. Well, we do now have today evidence that we do make something that lasts and lasts and lasts. PCBs were once used in electrical gear, paints, and flame retardants. They were banned from the 1970s onward because of their toxic effect in animals and humans. However, they persist in the environment and are accumulating at dangerously high levels in Europe's killer whales and dolphins, according to scientists. Europe's cetaceans have levels of PCBs that are among the highest found in any of the oceans. A wildlife veterinarian from the Zoological Society of London says, for striped dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, and killer whales, we have mean PCB levels. He means average, mean as in average, not nasty, that are excessive. They're really high, probably the highest in the world right now. Europe is a big, big hotspot, he says. The contamination is so high, some populations of killer whales are facing extinction. This is published in scientific reports. PCBs were banned in the U.S. in 1979 and in the rest of Europe in the late 80s. They have a wide-ranging impact on human and animal health, from links to cancer to suppressing the immune system to causing reproductive problems. They're versatile. They're extremely durable, and despite the ban, they're still plentiful in the environment. So, yes, next time your children ask you, we do make something that lasts. It's called PCBs. The quote for the weekend comes from Matt Barnes, a scholarly gent who used to play, well, he still plays professional basketball. He just doesn't do it in Los Angeles anymore, but does it in Memphis. And he had an running verbal altercation with his former teammate on the Los Angeles basketball team, the Lakers, because apparently that former teammate, who's now the coach of a New York basketball team, has had a romantic thing with the ex or the estranged girlfriend of Matt Barnes. And so there were thoughts as the two teams squared off this weekend, and Matt Barnes has been tweeting some nasty stuff about this situation, that there might be some, hanky-panky, or just panky, actually. And Matt Barnes dissuaded folks from that sense that anything untoward might happen with these words, which I think not only speak for every American politician who, it's just a little too explicit for American politicians to say, but in their hearts they know he's right. And words to live by on the weekend before Martin Luther King Day. These are the quote. These are the words of Matt Barnes regarding this potential altercation between him and the guy who's hanging with his ex-squeeze. Quote, "Violence is never the answer, but sometimes it is." Hello, welcome to the show.
Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna have some fun. Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna get some loving on. Before I nut them but skull and bones, gonna get on mice like a rolling stone. Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna have my fun. Oh, nah. Ain't ready for the boneyard, ain't ready for the boneyard.
Ready for the boneyard.
We are heading to the boneyard, are heading to the boneyard.
Boneyard.
Ain't ready for the boneyard, ain't ready for the boneyard.
Ready for the boneyard.
From London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this one right here, this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, yes, once again, it's news of the Olympic movement. Still produced by Jim Ebersole Jr., who does not exist. Well, the Wall Street Journal has come on board. They did a big story this week on problems with the Olympics in Rio. Really? One of the first concerns for organizers is whether Brazilians, who don't care much about some Olympic sports, will buy enough tickets to meet financial targets. As of last December 31st, less than half of the 4.5 million domestic market tickets had been sold. The organizing committee is depending on ticket sales to meet 17% of its budget needs. The committee, Olympic Committee spokesman down there, Philip Wilkinson, doesn't sound Brazilian, said the group is comfortable with the sales, quote, given that Brazilian buying habits tend to see tickets being bought closer to the date of events, unquote. Whistling through the what yard? Olympic budgets are often built to be exploded, of course, says the Wall Street Journal, but these games have been beset by major overruns at a time when the country can ill afford them. Last year, the total infrastructure cost for the games, funded mostly by the federal and local governments, rose to more than $5.5 billion, 25% higher than originally planned. To fight the city's notorious congestion, Rio's notorious congestion, organizers are extending a subway line 16 kilometers, but the state is going to need another $247 million in federal government funds to complete the work, and they're arguing about who's going to come up with the funds. Brazil is also grappling with serious mosquito-borne diseases that so far are outracing officials' efforts to deal with them. As of early December, a record 1.58 million cases of dengue fever were reported in Brazil last year. Chikungunya is mushrooming too. Most worrisome is a relatively new fast-spreading virus called Zika. Zika is spreading quickly in Rio de Janeiro state. Rio's mayor promised last year to buy more than a million tickets available for the games and give them away to school children for free. He has not yet done so. But wait, there's more. Not from the Wall Street Journal, from the Associated Press. Brazilian organizers are meeting with sports federation leaders. World Rowing Executive Director Matt Smith already knows what to expect. He's bracing for news that 4,000 temporary grandstand seats at the Rowing Olympic venue won't be built. At the swimming venue, several thousand seats have already been slashed. The world governing body for sailing learned more than a year ago that bleachers it wanted had been ruled out. Rio organizers are scaling down everywhere to eliminate about $500 million. I've been around since Los Angeles in 1984. We haven't been in such a situation where a country that is staging the games is in such a vulnerable situation, Smith of the Rowing Federation said. Hit by cash flow problems, Rio is reducing the use of unpaid volunteers. Transportation is being rejigged. Few competition results will be bailable on paper. And organizers, having backed away from plans to have athletes pay for air conditioning in their rooms, are firm that all rooms in the Olympic Village won't have televisions. They can't watch the games. There is more. In a report released this week by the World Anti-Doping Agency, an independent commission mentioned evidence that several million dollars in sponsorship money reportedly paid by Japan to the International Association of Athletics Federations may have swayed then-IAA chief Lamine Diak to favor Tokyo's bid for the 2020 Summer Olympics. The report, a follow-up to the Commission's November findings on widespread doping and corruption in Russia's athletic program, alleges conflicts of interest in world track and field under the former IOC member Diak and misconduct reaching to criminal acts of conspiracy and bribery. A footnote of the report mentions discussions between Turkish track officials and Diak's son, Khalil, describing competition between Istanbul, Madrid, and Tokyo for the 2020 Games, which ended up being awarded to Japan, summarizing that Turkey lost Diak's support because they did not pay sponsorship monies of $5 million either to the then-burgeoning Diamond League, which was a track and field league, or to the IAAF. According to the transcript, the Japanese did pay such a sum. That is the end of the footnote. The commission did not dig into the matter further as it was not within the purview of their investigation. They did approach Interpol, said a Tokyo spokesperson. The note in the report is beyond our understanding. The games were awarded to Tokyo because the city presented the best bid. said Hikariko Ono. Like Yoko, but without the screaming. Tokyo's bid was about Japan's commitment to address issues around the integrity of sport. Well, you could interpret that one of two ways. And back to Rio, Olympic fans have been warned there will be no hospital beds for them if they get sick during Rio 2016. A cash shortage, mentioned earlier, has plunged the city into a healthcare crisis, according to the British newspaper The Telegraph. Some major hospitals have been forced to close their doors. Even the most seriously ill patients cannot be admitted because of a funding shortfall that means a daily deficit of 150 beds. Please send beds. Union leaders say the state of Rio de Janeiro was not prepared for the extra burden of the Olympics, which is predicted to bring as much as 1 million extra people to the city. Didn't they know it was coming? It's like the airplane, when your airplane lands at an airport early and they scramble, or on time even, and then you sit on the tarmac because they don't have a gate. Didn't they know we were coming? Jorge Darce, president of the doctors' union, said, "We are really in a very serious situation in which there is not the slightest possibility of a short-term solution. It is impossible," he says, "for doctors in Rio to stay quiet given the possibility that a million people will arrive in our state. Our objective is not to stop people coming, but to make sure those who come know that there will not be facilities when they fall sick in Brazil," unquote. Dr. Darje warned that foreign tourists would be particularly susceptible to tropical illnesses such as dengue fever and the recent outbreak of Zika virus, which is carried by the same mosquito. That's a versatile mosquito. Last week, an emergency cabinet announced it will draft an extra 2,400 health professionals to bolster the public health care system in Rio after the local government declared a state of emergency. The federal government announced immediate extra funding of about $10 million. Two state hospitals have been taken over by the city. The authorities have blamed the funding crisis on the drop in oil prices. So, pay more at the pump if you want healthcare in Rio. Isn't globalization wonderful? The doctors' union, by the way, said such reasons were unacceptable. It's all unacceptable when it's the Olympics. It's a movement, and we all need one. Every day! Wow. That is one versatile mosquito, though. I have to hand it to it. Hand what to it? How do you hand something to a mosquito? Now...
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an
inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
News of inspectors general, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening whatever. Veterans who are seeking... This is a healthcare kind of a dominated show so far. Veterans seeking urgent care at the VA hospital in Montgomery, Virginia, spent too much time in the emergency room, according to the Inspector General for Veterans Affairs. Non-mental health patients spent an average 3.5 hours in the emergency room. I hope they got a lot of magazines. Mental health patients spent twice that long. That'll teach them. The Montgomery, Alabama. Sorry, not Virginia. Too many Montgomerys in the United States, don't you think? The Central Alabama Veterans Healthcare System did not meet the VA's timeliness measures, according to the IG. VA facilities are considered fully satisfactory if fewer than 10% of their emergency room patients are there less than 6 hours, and exceptional if fewer than 5% are there less than 6 hours. The bar is pretty high in the VA hospital system, apparently. The Montgomery emergency room did not meet either standard for about the last 4 or 5 years. The extended ER stays were due to patients waiting for admission to the hospital, undergoing treatment, or awaiting transfer to another facility for radiology or ultrasound services, according to the Inspector General, during the week of the audit, 4% of the patients who arrived at the emergency room left before they were seen by medical staff. Other stuff to do. You know? I got health care. I got to get well, but I also got to go to the grocery store. Something. Got to do something else. This is higher than the acceptable standard of people leaving before they see medical staff, according to the Inspector General. Fewer than 3% of patients leaving without being seen is considered fully satisfactory, in case you were wondering. Fewer than 1% is exceptional. The Montgomery Veterans Hospital met the fully satisfactory level for only 1 month during the last 5 years. Never met the exceptional level. One thing you can say about that hospital, it's consistent. The United States has spent nearly $500 million in 5 years developing Afghanistan's oil, gas, and minerals industries and has little to show for it, according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the SIGAR, S-I-G-A-R. The project's failings are the result of poorly planned programs. He likes his alliteration. Inadequate infrastructure, there you go, and a challenging partnership with the Afghan government. That's the latest report from the SIGAR. The finding comes after some 200 reports from the Inspector General have detailed inefficient, unsuccessful, or downright wasteful reconstruction projects. So we're winning, right? Let's see if the Taliban can do better. A recent analysis of his reports found that there have been at least $17 billion in questionable spending. Yeah, we've got that on us. The United States Agency for International Development and a Pentagon task force were in charge of developing a so-called extractive industry in Afghanistan, basically a system for getting precious resources out of the ground and to the commercial market. SIGAR denounced both USAID and the Defense Department for their failures to coordinate. Really? The Defense Department? You're kidding. And to ascertain the ability of Afghans to sustain the project. Where have we heard this before? If we build it, they will let it fall apart. In fact, when international aid stopped supporting the Afghan office responsible for oversight of the petroleum and natural gas industries, 2/3 of that office's staff were fired. Well, where's the money? Goodbye. Pilots are so used to using automation technology in the cockpit. These are professional, you know, airline pilots. Experts are now worried that some of them lack the skills to manually fly planes. So let's get those self-driving cars on the road, shall we? That concern, not about the cars, but about the planes, was summarized by the Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Transportation. He took the FAA to task, saying the agency does not know how many pilots are capable of actually taking the controls if their electrical systems fail them. That would be nice to know, wouldn't it? While airlines have long used automation safely to improve efficiency and reduce pilot workload, several recent accidents, including a July 2013 crash of Asiana Airlines Flight 214, have shown that pilots who typically fly with automation can make errors when confronted with an unexpected event or transitioning to manual flying. This is according to the Inspector General's report to the FAA. He goes on to report that Asiana Airlines Flight 214 crashed while the pilots were attempting a landing at San Francisco International Airport. The NTSB determined the crew's reliance on automation was a contributing factor. Quote, we've recommended that pilots have more opportunity to practice manually flying the aircraft, said Robert Sumwalt, who was a pilot for 30-plus years before joining the National Transportation Safety Board, pointing to the issues raised by his own agency. The FAA responded to the Inspector General's letter, saying they have a commitment to enhance training requirements. So just looking forward. When we get those self-driving cars, soon enough, the NTSB will recommend that we make sure that people who own self-driving cars just, you know, get sufficient training in manually driving the cars just in case. Don't you think? I do. News of Inspectors General, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
You lie like it's your sacred duty. I beg for trouble like a prayer. Oh, how I'd hate to have to love you. Oh, my angel of despair. How I'd hate to have to love you.
From London, this is Le Show, and now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry. Sorry.
Well, first of all, we have Senator Ted Cruz in the Republican presidential debate earlier this past week. There was a moment when Senator Cruz accused his leading opponent in the presidential primary so far, Donald Trump, of having so-called, Cruz called, New York values. As you may surely be aware, Trump responded by citing the heroism of New Yorkers, first responders, and others in the wake of the 9/11 disaster. And supposedly, Cruz, a Republican senator from Texas, was somewhat back-footed by Trump's response. Later, he was asked for an apology, and he delivered this one.
I apologize to the millions of New Yorkers who've been let down by liberal politicians in that state. And I apologize to all the cops and the firefighters and 9/11 heroes who had no choice but to stand and turn their back on Mayor de Blasio, because Mayor de Blasio over and over again.
Well, that's a good soundbite, isn't it? Turn their backs on Mayor de Blasio, he said, because Mayor de Blasio had let them down. Anyway, that's the sardonic apology of Senator Ted Cruz. Volkswagen chief executive Matthias Mueller has apologized for cheating diesel car emissions tests during his first official U.S. visit since the scandal broke last September. Quote, "We know that we have let down customers, authorities, and regulators, and the general public here in America," the head of the German carmaker said in an even phonier accent at a media reception. I am truly sorry for that, and I would like to apologize once again for what went wrong at Volkswagen. He said, our most important task in 2016 is to win back trust. It's not only our cars we have to fix, we have to repair our credibility, too. And to that end, they're installing a cheating device in their credibility. No! Sorry. He insisted, speaking to journalists after his speech, quote, "We are not a criminal brand or group. Volkswagen made huge technical mistakes," he said, "but had no intention to deceive the U.S. public or regulators." So why'd you put the so-called cheating device in, sir? It was just a happy accident. Metallica, the famed heavy metal band, has apologized to Sandman, a Canadian tribute band, after Sandman received a cease and desist letter from Metallica's attorney, asking them to discontinue using Metallica's official stylized logos on or to identify or promote live musical performances through Facebook and YouTube. That's the verbiage of the letter. Said Metallica in a statement, "We hear that the tribute band is a little upset with us, and with a little digging, we figured out why. It turns out a certain letter was delivered to Sandman that neither we nor our management were aware of. Lucky for us, the band was kind enough to post it for us to see. And it turns out we have a very overzealous attorney who sent this letter without our knowledge. We have a long history of not only enjoying tribute bands, we started as one. Sandman should file the letter in the trash." I'm continuing to quote Metallica, something I barely do. "We've spoken to Sandman's Joe Taranto, and it's all good. Keep doing what you're doing. We totally support you. In the meantime, our attorney can be found at SFO Airport catching a flight to go permanently ice fishing in Alaska." De Toronto told Rolling Stone, Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich called him to personally apologize. "He gave me and the band his full blessing to continue on as we were," said De Toronto. They want us to continue paying tribute to Metallica with their full blessing and approval. This is not the first time Metallica has clashed with other parties over infringement issues. In January 1999, the band sued Victoria's Secret after it sold a lipstick line dubbed Metallica. The lingerie company ended up settling with the band. That's all I can say. To be continued. Air Force officials in Georgia, I believe that's the United States, Georgia, have apologized for using an image of Martin Luther King Jr. to advertise a gun shoot. The 78th Support Squadron put out posters bearing the Nobel Peace Prize winner's image for a, quote, fun shoot, unquote, on the holiday that celebrates his birth. Not kidding. Right here on the page, right here. Robins Air Force Base's Leroy Minus. Oh, come on. I just read him. Leroy Minus told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that the flyer was, that is to say, the poster, the leaflet, not the Air Force pilot. The flyer was created by a marketing team. Oh, well then, that explains that. And apologized for associating the slain leader killed with target practice. Quote, "We realized the inappropriateness of the advertisement several days ago and immediately began removing the flyer," the statement said. Adding the Air Force did not want to cast the nonviolent resistance leader in a negative light. The statement said it was an honest mistake. I wonder what a dishonest mistake would have been like in this situation. And that those involved will receive remedial training. In what? More questions than answers in that one. And the Canadian Olympic Committee has apologized to its employees and unveiled sweeping changes to workplace policies in the wake of a sexual harassment scandal that forced the former president of the Canadian Olympic Committee, Marcel Aubu, to resign. The board of directors also agreed to implement all the recommendations made in a tough third-party workplace review of its handling of the Aubu affair that identified gaps in the area of human resources, systems, and processes. Yes, human resources has both systems and processes. It's clear from the report that the board and the senior leadership team could have done more, and for that I apologize, said the Canadian Olympic president, Tricia Smith. We all own this and are truly sorry. We failed our employees. Aubu, 68 years old, resigned last October amid allegations that he sexually harassed a female colleague. A week later, two other women came forward with allegations. Who does he think he is, Bill Cosby? Ladies and gentlemen, the apology of the week. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, little news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. You are probably aware by now that Rupert Murdoch, the head of Nice Corp., has announced plans to marry Jerry Hall, former fashion model, longtime companion of Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger. They actually got married fairly late in their relationship, and then the marriage was ended, strangely enough, despite the fact that they'd been together for, probably a couple decades, ended by annulment. But, you know, it's Mick Jagger. Anyway, this would be Rupert Murdoch's fourth marriage. You remember the one to Wendy Deng. Before that was Anna, who gave him the two sons who are running his, in line to run his company, if, you know. And the first wife, who gave him a daughter. The guy who wrote a biography, Rupert Murdoch, Michael Wolff, wrote in GQ that apparently Jerry Hall, who's been seen publicly with Rupert for months now, cut her famous long blonde hair at Rupert's behest. She said, "I love a man with strong opinions." Mick Jagger, Rupert Murdoch, maybe not as different as you'd think.
Well, they call me the honky-tonk fogey, but this geezer's getting ready to blow. I'm lighting up a major stogie. I'm rocking my world nice and slow. I got me a rock and roll woman. Then I had a cut of hair. I know I look glum, but she's under my thumb. Wild horses couldn't end this affair. Refined sugar, I know you're bad for me. Refined sugar, but you're my next destiny. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, she had the height and the beauty. I had the power and greed. She said, "Can you give me shelter?" I said, "You can get what you need." She's a Siamese cat of a girl. I'm a man of wealth and taste. It's a drag getting old, but not to sound cold. A body's a terrible thing to waste. Refined sugar, I know you're bad for me. Refined sugar, I won't put you on page 3. I've got the gold and the silver. She makes a grown man cry in bed. She said when I gave her the diamond, "Keep fidelity in your head. I'll be like a little red rooster when we walk down the aisle arm in arm. We'll honeymoon in Claridge's when it comes to marriages. The fourth time is the charm." Refined sugar, I know you're bad for me. Refined sugar, you're what I take with tea.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen.
Dateline Salt Lake City. University of Utah lab experiments found that when temperatures get warmer, wood rats suffer a reduced ability to live on their normal diet of toxic creosote. That sounds like a bad thing. That's their diet, suggesting global warming may hurt plant-eating animals. The study adds to our understanding of how climate change may affect mammals in that their ability to consume dietary toxins is impaired by warmer temperatures, says the senior author. You see, not all animal diets are as toxic as those of wood rats and other rodents that eat plants like creosote bushes or juniper. Most mammals eat some toxins in their diet, not just humans. See, we're just trying to be like wood rats. Thank you, chemical industry. In an ongoing evolutionary battle, plants evolve chemical defenses against being eaten. Animals evolve liver enzymes or other ways to overcome or avoid plant toxins. Over 40% of all existing mammals eat only plants, like your elephant, your giraffe. Many more eat some plants, like me. Most plants produce toxins, so the majority of plant-eating animals eat toxic compounds. This may become more difficult to deal with as the climate warms, says the author. Animals that contain diets with toxic plants, animals with diets that contain toxic plants include rabbits, pikas, marmots, possums, deer, moose, elk, bighorn, sheep, horses, and cows. Any free-range domestic animal will face plants with toxins. No, plants don't have faces. Listen more carefully. First Nations, that's what the Canada calls what we call Native Americans, their catch of fish could decline by nearly 50% by 2050, according to a new study examining the threat of climate change to the food and economic security of Indigenous communities along coastal British Columbia in Canada. Climate change is likely to lead to declines in herring and salmon. They are among the most important species commercially, culturally, and nutritionally for First Nations, said a graduate student who headed the study. This could have large implications for communities who've been harvesting these fish and shellfish for millennia. Time to eat some pork. While many studies examine the impact of climate change on large commercial fisheries, few focus on Indigenous communities. This study finds that coastal First Nations communities could suffer economic losses between $6 and $12 million annually if they use money, and that's probably Canadian dollars. The study was published in PLOS One. The researchers modeled how climate change is likely to affect 98 culturally and commercially important fish and shellfish species between 2000 and 2050. Most of the 98 species would be affected by climate change. They projected the fish would move away from their current habitats toward cooler waters nearer the pole, and that would reduce the number of fish that could be caught by the Indigenous folks because they're generally confined to their traditional territories when fishing for food, as well as for social and ceremonial purposes. Maybe they got to get some frequent flyer miles on them. A new study by NOAA researchers suggests future warming of ocean waters off the northeastern U.S. may be greater and occur at an even faster pace than previously projected. Their findings, based on output from four global climate models of varying ocean and atmospheric resolution, indicate that ocean temperatures in the U.S. Northeast shelf is projected to warm twice as fast as previously projected, almost three times faster than the global average. That's going to make for some happy lobsters. You know, icebergs were bad news, giant icebergs, for at least one ocean-going vessel we all know about. But they could be responsible for the processes that absorb up to 20% of the carbon in at least the Southern Ocean, according to a new study. Researchers say meltwater from these vast blocks of ice release nutrients into the surrounding waters. That triggers plankton blooms, and the plankton absorb carbon dioxide. This is the first study of its kind. The authors examined satellite data between 2003 and 2013. This is in the journal Nature Geoscience. They tracked via satellite 17 giant icebergs through the open waters of the ocean surrounding Antarctica. We detect substantially enhanced chlorophyll levels over a radius at least 4 to 10 times the iceberg's length, which can persist for more than a month following the passage of a giant iceberg. These findings suggest this area of influence is more than an order of magnitude larger than that found for smaller icebergs. So as icebergs calve, that would mean there would be fewer plankton. The giant icebergs had much bigger plumes of phytoplankton than we'd previously expected, say the authors. This means the role of giant icebergs in the Southern Ocean carbon cycle is bigger than we had previously suspected. The phytoplankton behave like plants on land. In order to obtain the energy to grow and reproduce, they do photosynthesis, absorbing carbon dioxide. When they die, they sink to the ocean floor, locking away the carbon they absorbed. If giant iceberg calving increases this century as expected, the negative feedback on the carbon cycle may become more important than we previously thought. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, just a few moments for some news of our friend the Atom. I got a note from Addie the Atom. He is watching rugby with El Cheapo. Meanwhile, the Department of Energy's long-term plan for dealing with material contaminated with plutonium and heavy elements from the U.S. weapons program is to bury it, sure, underground in New Mexico at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. The Energy Department plan aims to safeguard nuclear material for the next 10,000 years, but three Stanford nuclear scientists point out in a new article in the journal Nature that the plant was not designed to hold as much plutonium as is now being considered for disposal there. The site has seen two accidents in recent years. These accidents during the first 15 years of operation really illustrate the challenge of predicting the behavior of a repository over 10,000 years, says one of the authors. What's more, there's more plutonium proposed for disposal at that plant in the future as a result of treaties with the former Soviet Union to decrease the number of nuclear weapons by dismantling them. The analysis proposing that it be diluted and disposed of at the plant in New Mexico does not include a revision of the safety analysis for the site, say the authors. They call on the Department of Energy to take another look at the safety assessment of the sites, particularly emphasizing the drilling activity in the oil-rich Permian Basin where the storage facility is located. The current regulatory period of 10,000 years, they write, is short relative to the 24,000-year half-life of plutonium-239, let alone that of its decay product, uranium-235, which has a half-life of 700 million years. We cannot be certain that future inhabitants of the area will even know the storage facility is there, they added. It's important to understand the impact of future drilling in the area. Clean, cheap, safe. Too long live to meter. It's our friend, the Atom. Oh, one more note about the Atom. There's this nuclear power plant in Florida called Turkey Point. It's been drawing cooling water from the freshwater nearby. And the freshwater's been getting hot. As the Florida Power and Light Company pumped more than 100 million gallons a day of fresh water to cool the reactors, phosphorus and ammonia levels have shot up dramatically in the aquifer under Biscayne Bay. That's where the people in 3 million people in South Florida get their drinking water from that aquifer. You're welcome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. Program returns next week at the same time, oddly enough, over these same stations, even more oddly. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world by the internet, you've heard of it, at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast at Sideshow Network, SoundCloud, iTunes, tunein.com, and WWNO.org. And it'd be just like Jerry Hall being just a shout away if you'd agree to join with me then, will you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A typical show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London, and to Jenny Lawson at WWNO in New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. Do you use email? The email address for this program? Hey, join the conversation. And a playlist of the music heard here on, as well as your opportunity to buy Cars I Talk t-shirts. People think I'm joking when I say that. I'm not. That's all available at harryshearer.com. And speaking of that conversation you're supposed to join, I'm on the Twitter at the Harry Shearer. In case you tuned in late, our quote for Martin Luther King Day comes from Memphis Grizzlies professional basketball forward Matt Barnes. Violence is never the answer, but sometimes it is. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.